Welcome to another edition of We Need to Talk About Movies, brought to you by BanterFlix.com. And now, here's your host, Jim McClain.
Hello, hello, hello. Yes, I am indeed your host, Jim McClain, the editor-in-chief of the BanterFlix Movie Review website. Welcome to the latest episode of our podcast, We Need to Talk About Movies. If this is your first time checking out the pod, then welcome to the madness. This is our first proper pod of 2021. For the last few weeks, we have been dipping into the vault here at Banter HQ and reissuing a few older recordings. And now it's time to get back into, well, the virtual studio for now because of the continued lockdown here in Northern Ireland. But it's great to be back. Great to get talking about movies again. And this week we have a great show lined up for you. We're going to be talking about Sam Pollard's MLK FBI. The documentary is now available to rent on various VOD platforms. And the reason why we're talking about it on this show is because Dogwoof, who are the distributors here in the UK, have teamed up with the Strand Arts Centre here in Belfast. And if you go on to Dogwoof's own online player on their website, and you can rent some of their titles. And specifically with MLK FBI, you can rent the title and you can help support the Strand Arts Centre because they've teamed up with Dogwoof to do this. And it means that the revenue from your rental is split 50-50, I believe. So it's a great way to support the Strand whilst they're closed. We love the Strand in East Belfast. We've worked with them quite a lot over the years. And it feels weird in January not to be sitting at this point planning out an entire screening programme. And I'm sure we would have, in normal times, definitely been doing some stuff with the Strand. But anyway, let's not dwell on that. We have a great pod lineup for you. We have contributors from Slugger O'Toole, from the Golden Thread Gallery, and of course from the Strand Arts Centre. They'll be talking to yours truly. This pod is about an hour and 15 minutes in length. I'll be back at the very end in the outro with some usual housekeeping for the pod. But before we get into playing our discussion about MLK FBI, let's play a clip of the film.
Violence is self-defeating. He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword.
You know, when you construct a man as a great man, there's nothing almost more satisfying than also seeing him as the opposite.
When the National Archive puts government documents up on the web, one has to confront them.
Tapes from the hotel rooms, FBI reports, those are pieces of information that we shouldn't have. The FBI was most alarmed about King because of his success.
He realized how sick this country was. We were trying to reveal the truth about segregation.
J. Edgar Hoover is famous for saying that he feared the rise of a black messiah.
The FBI says it's clear Martin Luther King Jr. is the most dangerous Negro in America, and we have to use every resource at our disposal to destroy him.
So that's a clip of MLK FBI, and this is our first pod of 2021. We've had enough of being lazy, listeners, and we're not reissuing any other podcast for a while. We're back talking about some new films, and we're delighted to be talking about this film because of a partnership that is currently going on with The Strand and Dogwoof. We'll come back to that and talk a little bit more. But before we get into discussing the film and some of the issues that arise within it, I thought I'd introduce my panel. And once again, for our first panel of 2021, I feel a bit like Nick Fury from The Avengers. I think I've got a crack team assembled here. So we've got partnerships with, we've got people from Slugger O'Toole, we have people from the Strand Arts Centre, we have people from the Golden Thread Gallery. We've a bit of all bases have been covered. Joining me on this pod is Joanna Leach from the Strand Arts Centre. Hello, Joanna.
Hello.
And we have Esther Anderi from the Golden Thread Gallery. Hello to you.
Hi.
Esther, you're making your pod debut. Do you want to very quickly tell our listeners here at Banterflix a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Esther. And as you can tell from the accent, I'm from England. I came over to Belfast for uni. So I finished history undergrad and now I'm doing a master's in law. I work at the Gordon's Bed as an intern, a position that came after, like, you know, COVID and just new needs. And the new needs that was found was obviously diversity and inclusion. I'm here, well, I'm part of the gallery to try and improve that and see what needs to be done within the art sector in Northern Ireland. So yeah, that's all about me in a succinct way.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I'm delighted to have you on the pod and making your debut. We have someone who's making her return performance on the pod, and that is Sarah Creighton, not the Garage People, but a solicitor and writer. It's on your Twitter profile, Sarah, so I felt the need I could do that joke.
Yeah, you have to. It's standard.
It's what we have to do. And finally, we have Mick Fealty from Slugger O2. Hello to you, Mick.
Hi, Jim. How you doing?
So, Mick, you're making your debut as well. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, look, for those that are politically obsessed, you might have heard of a website called Slugger O'Toole. I've been running that for about the last 18 years. Probably the longest running political website, or certainly political blog, on these islands, continuously running anyway. And we used to do a lot of culture, but we seem to have run out of culture. I think culture and politics work quite well. And I think, you know, the film we're about to talk about today, I think really is a good example of that.
Yeah, I definitely think that's why, of course, it was Alan Meeban who had suggested yourself. So that's why we reached out. So, yes, we're going to be talking about the documentary MLK FBI. And Joanna, just kind of before we get into the nitty gritty and discussing the film and sharing our thoughts, do you want to tell us a little bit about this partnership that exists between yourself and Dogwoof for the film that we're talking about?
Yeah, so Dogwoof are a reasonably small and slightly nicher film distributor. We've worked with them over the last couple of years, obviously doing physical film screenings, which we're not allowed to do anymore. So we have a couple of distributors like Dogwoof have set up their websites to kind of have their own video player that you can watch their films on. So you can go on now and you can watch I Am Greta or other previous films that they've released, and you just pay, like, similar if you were paying something onto Amazon. But what they've done, which is a bit different, is instead of the money going straight to Amazon and them receiving a smaller amount, is that money can go directly to them and there's no middleman. And what they've done is offered up a partnership with other independent venues like ourselves, and we're a charity as well. So it just means that 50% of the ticket money goes to the Strand Arts Centre and 50% goes to Dogwoof. And so that's really brilliant for us, especially when we don't have the resources to kind of start our own player, or, you know, it's very difficult to kind of start making brokering, you know, deals with other film distributors and different things. And we just really aren't able to do that. So this is the first one we decided to go for. The passion that I had originally was I've been starting up global film screenings and want to show more culturally diverse films, connecting them with Northern Ireland and having kind of open discussions about them. So this is a perfect film for us to start off with.
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4-6 Success Filmmaking. 4-6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4-6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness, direct from the voices that have lived it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic documentary, I have to say. I watched this. I actually used the Dogwoof partnership to kind of go in and watch this. And I know the Dogwoof have supplied us as well with screeners for our contributors, so we have to thank them as well. But we will also put the link up. The link's already up on an article on our website for people who want to find out about the partnership and how they can support the Strand and watch the film. But we'll also put it in the bio for this documentary. So we'll open it out and we'll move away specifically from that and we'll talk about the film itself. And Esther, I'll start with you. Tell me, you know, from watching the film, what did you take from MLK FBI?
What did I take? Well, the first thing is that the FBI and American government, it would seem, will go to large efforts to kind of stalk, I guess you can put it, great civil rights movement activists, you know, because it wasn't just Martin Luther, they were doing this too, as Malcolm X, Angela Davis and stuff like that. But when it comes to other things like, let's say, white supremacy or racism, that's actually an inherent issue there. There isn't that much done. And that was actually pointed out, noted in the documentary, that there's so much that could be done. And Martin Luther did say that in terms of, like, you know, the Birmingham fire with the four girls and like the Mississippi murders, nothing was done or no one was arrested. But again, lots of effort was put into finding out what Martin Luther King was doing, who he was sleeping with, where he was, and not shocking, not surprising, just upsetting, really. Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't something that shocked me, but I have to hold my hand up here to admit, I didn't know the full context and the full context of which the FBI had been surveying Martin Luther King until I think I'd watched Selma in 2014, because that's a big issue in that. There's a lot of talk about phone tapping and the harassment that he got, and that really opened my eyes. And it's something that I don't really, maybe I'm just looking back with rose-tinted glasses. When I was younger, I didn't know. That wasn't taught to me, anything like that. It was very basic understanding of what was going on with Martin Luther King in America and the civil rights movement. Sarah, moving to yourself, you know, your initial thoughts and what you took from the documentary, I suppose, before we really get into specifics of certain key points and key issues within the film.
Yeah, no, it was a really, really interesting documentary. It was fascinating in a dark sort of way. It was a history that I was aware of, though I think it was similar to, not as much detail as it went into that documentary. And I think it was relevant. I remember it was during Martin Luther King Day. I think the FBI on Twitter like praised them, or said, put a tweet, and everybody on Twitter was like, hang on a minute. You know, so I think what I took, my first initial impression was, I think what you said at the beginning was how much hasn't changed in some ways. And obviously there has been certain many changes in America, but I came away from that thinking, gosh, there's so many similarities between then and now.
Yeah, because when I was watching the documentary, I was watching it on the day of the inauguration of Sleepy Joe Biden, everyone's favorite sleepy uncle. But I kind of got surprised. And when you're watching that documentary and then you have Joe Biden saying in his inauguration speech that one of the things he wants to tackle is white supremacy, and you kind of go, this is from the 1960s. This documentary is dealing with what was going on then. I know it's from recently declassified documents. I know there's going to be more documents that are going to be declassified. I think it's 2027. I'm sure we'll come to that. But yeah, it did feel, and in the last 12 months beyond COVID with the Black Lives Matter, it just feels so depressingly relevant now. And that's my kind of takeaway from the film. You know, I do think it's quite, and I'm going to choose my words carefully, it's quite a dry documentary in terms of it's no talking heads. It's just giving you a lot of facts. And I think, looking at an interview, I think there's only about 8 interviewees. There's not a lot of interviewers, not a lot of interviewees throughout the documentary. And it is, maybe through lockdown, I find myself watching a lot of PBS America. And it's the type of thing I think would find its home there. But that doesn't mean I wouldn't say to anyone listening or watching now to seek it out, because it is in the context of what we've seen, as I say, with the Black Lives Matter in the last 12 months and that resurgence of that. I think it's an important document of looking back and putting things into historical context. That's enough of me rambling. Mick, I'll come to you. And as I say, before we go into the specifics of kind of the certain key things within the documentary, your initial thoughts and what you took away from it. You know, were you familiar with what was going on with Martin Luther King going into the documentary?
There's two things, right? One, I think it's an archival triumph. There is a credit as they roll down for the archival editor, who is extraordinarily important in this. One of the most impressive things is the quality of the news, because a lot of it is really footage. And although there are talking heads, you don't see them. It's a bit like Joyce's, Ulysses. there are certain chapters that start there, and you're, because there's no narrator, you aren't told necessarily who this person is. You see names flashed, but you don't really know who they are, and it's a certain kind of adventure. Now, I was actually around when Martin Luther King was assassinated. It's probably one of those, and Robert Kennedy was shot in the same year, so it was like a double whammy. I was very young when John F. Kennedy was killed, so I don't have any real adult memories of that. So it really brought me right back to that. So he died in 68. We had our troubles in 69. I was kind of going with the years of the decade. So a lot of what feeds into that is very much in line with some of my fragmentary childhood memory of watching this stuff all unfold. Well, one of the really striking things, this is a stylistic point, but it's, I think it's an important one. The thing that we all know about Martin Luther King is the "I Have a Dream" speech, and you know, the extraordinary foresight of the last speech that he made before he was shot. But because it's all in black and white, because it gives you all this granular detail, because it gives you a lot of the progress from the 50s right through to the, you know, 62, 63, when he does the March on Washington, right to the very last year when he's starting to get into something rather different, which is a crusade against poverty, not just about race. It has a cumulative effect on you, this film, as it goes over. And the really refreshing thing is when you get towards the end, you finally get to see who all these hidden voices are. Now, not all of them come on screen, but I think it's a really pleasant kind of release from this tension that's building up the whole way through. And then the summative stuff, one of the things they start with is a great quote from the person who is introducing him on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial with this massive crowd of mostly African-American citizens out in front of the National Mall. And he introduces Martin Luther King as I've got it written down here, the moral leader of our nation, right? And there's just something very epic about that. But morality, it's almost a morality tale that's going on here. And I think they use some of the fragmentary documents from the FBI, which are mostly fished out through, kind of individual inquiries, to really talk about the moral ambiguity around leadership, but the power of that moral leadership too. So I thought it was very moving, not least because it took me right back to those days of just watching from Hollywood, you know, as a kid, and watching those black and white pictures. So very, very powerful.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. You know, it's coming back to the fact that I said I watched this on the inauguration of Joe Biden. It's kind of strange when you're watching that, and I suppose you have to put in the context of the COVID stuff, and we think of the lack of people that were there and that day, and then we see watching later that day, you're watching this documentary and you're seeing that kind of almost kind of in the same kind of same area, same kind of backdrop, and you just see, as you say, the moral leader of America. Joanna, I suppose I spoke to you about the Dog Whiff kind of partnership and the importance of that. I suppose I didn't really ask you, you know, your thoughts, your initial thoughts on the film itself. So do you want to tell us now what you thought of MLK FBI?
Yeah, I would agree with Mick. I do a lot of work with archive material myself through Northern Ireland Screen Digital Film Archive. And so it's something that I am very aware of. And it's unbelievable. What I kind of had written down here was that it's using the black and white footage mainly, but also the use of archive and other films. So what you've seen was up in the top corner, you would have like, "I Was a Communist for the FBI," "The FBI," "FBI Story," and how that, you know, and that's why maybe it's such a dense kind of documentary, is because there isn't any actors or staged scenes for you that, you know, to kind of relate to characters. So it can seem a little bit impersonal at times, but then that's the investigation feel, I think, and looking at it in a way where trying to not make it personal about Martin Luther King, you know, and it's about what he did and what happened to him. And I think that was really important, because if you do watch Selma, you know, it's a historical drama. You get emotionally involved whenever you find out that he's having affairs. You care about how his wife might feel, whereas in this, that isn't seen in that kind of way, and it's not Hollywoodized. So I kind of enjoyed that, and I think, you know, it's very important. And, you know, like Mick had also mentioned that, and at the end it was also looking at kind of poverty, and the racial injustice and poverty are such a big thing in America. And the thing that got me at the start of the movie was that swooning moment, because I connected my laptop to TV to try and get the biggest screen I could apart from the Strand, and it's that moment of wow, because I've been there. I've been and I've stood where he's stood, and I've been and I spent 9 weeks in Washington, D.C. working with African-Americans in one of the poorer places within Washington, D.C. With the Arts Council had sent me as a visual artist. So I kind of got to know people on the ground. I lived just around the corner from Frederick Douglass's house. I could see the Capitol as the crow flies, but I saw the poverty. I saw the unemployment. So, you know, for me, that moment of going, wow, the scale of that, the scale of filling that space, and also that it's not corporate, but that kind of government space, that Washington, D.C. is the type of place that when I was there, it functions from 9 to 5, grandiose with buildings, beautiful museums, massive statues, and at nighttime it's lit up, and it's very romantic when you walk around it, and you don't remember those protests, or you don't remember those swaths of people that stand there, because, you know, when I was there, everyone commutes in and out, everyone lives in Maryland. So it was like at nighttime I was completely alone walking around these grand buildings, and it's a very eerie place. So that, you know, a kind of putting him in that space was kind of a very different thing at the time for him to be seen not in Atlanta, or, you know, I think it's a very important point too.
Yeah, I would completely agree. The one thing that I noticed, I think it's very early on, I'm not sure which of the interviewees says it, we talk about this declassified documentation that has helped them kind of fill in the pictures and fill in the blanks a little with this archive footage. I think it's nearly 400 hours of archive footage they went through to get this, to bring together this film. I think it's 3 years in production from memory. But there's a key quote, and I think it's along the lines, if I turn my iPad on, I will get it here. But it's basically saying that what these declassified documents do is help fill in the pictures of trying to get to know the man that is Martin Luther King. But it's the fact is, we should never really have had these documents, this surveillance, the surveillance that they did, the underhanded nature. As I've mentioned, there's a letter that is a key issue within this documentary, and a letter that was sent by the FBI to Martin Luther King to let them know basically that they were aware of what he was up to, and that he should kill himself. And you get surprised, because I listened to an interview with the film's director, where he says that James Comey, who is in this documentary, well, he's talking in it, he uses this letter now as a way to show this is what the FBI should not be doing and should not be operating. And that letter in context, that horrified me. I don't know, whoever wants to kind of to go first, I'll start with yourself, Sarah. You know, your thoughts on that the letter is such a key point within this documentary, but your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it is. And I made a note of it, and James Comey said it was the darkest part of the borough's history. And I thought, well, I think it's your history, James Comey. You know, I think that is your history. You know, I think you can try and pretend that the borough, this was like some instance, and there was one of the girls in the film documentary, she said, you can try and pretend that this was the FBI going rogue, but it wasn't. It was done with support. People said it was a good thing. You know, the footage of, you know, the president of the United States, Johnson, you know, kind of talking to Edgar J. Hoover, who was himself an incredibly notoriously nasty man, in my opinion. And I think really, I came away from the documentary, I watched it soon after the inauguration as well, and it was that, you know, that contradiction between, I think it was that quote at the end where someone said it's about what America thinks it is and what it actually is. And it's that, you know, the FBI, the films about the FBI, and it interspersed with all those different pictures show this is how America sees the FBI, as this upstanding, strong, brave defenders. And even now you'll see people you know, even Joe Biden has talked about the FBI being these brave, noble people. And no doubt there's people in the FBI have done great work and have, you know, done a lot of things for national security. But it's that where they were raised up to this level of being these sort of honorable men, and they just weren't. And I think it just shows to me that kind of undercurrent of white supremacy and racism that just runs through America, still runs through America. In that particular sense, I think it was the other interesting aspect that I found was how they linked Martin Luther King to communism and Marxism. But maybe we'll come on to that later. But It's that contradiction that I thought the Comey thinking, this is a dark part of our history. I thought, well, no, James, it's your history.
I think one of the things that surprised me the most in the documentary, and again, you're looking at things where we're in 2021 and you're looking back. But at the time in the 1960s, I think they mentioned this in the documentary, but J. Edgar Hoover was apparently more popular than Martin Luther King. And it goes into things both Joanna and Sarah have mentioned, the fact that we had this idea, I don't want to go as far as to say propaganda, but we had this idea. I think, is it one of them had Jimmy Stewart, and Jimmy Stewart's everyone's hero. Well, he is one of my heroes. And there's a series with him or a movie with him. And you just think, you know, yeah, of course, that all plays into our idea of what we think the FBI is and what it stands for, and it's out to get the bad guys. But when reality, when you see what they're doing, it was just one of the things that really kind of surprised me. But then I suppose, you know, we're looking at things now, we're looking back. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. The power of hindsight's a wonderful thing, to have all this archive footage and all this declassified documentation. It helps fill in those blanks, but it's just a strange thing at the time. Coming to yourself, Esther, your thoughts on the letter, as I mentioned, and also kind of the idea that J. Edgar Hoover back at the time was deemed by America to be more popular than Martin Luther King.
When the letter actually came up in the documentary, I just thought about the Selma scene, you know, when Mrs. Martin Luther King Jr. got the letter, and like you just hear I think you hear the cries actually of her, like when she's reading it, the confusion. That's literally what I thought about. And I was just like, it's shocking, especially when you heard the FBI try to write it in like not colloquial language, but a language from someone from the inside. And then they went on about talking about how the FBI would have people from the inside, like be informants and stuff like that, to these movements, kind of to break it from the within. And it's just that idea that you can't feel trusted. And that's how Martin Luther King like would have felt after he read the letter, being like, what is my private life being exposed just like that to everyone? Like, I'm not trusted in my own home. I'm not trusted within my own personal space. And the letter, the intentions, everything behind it, you can't even say it's disgusting, because it's not humane. Like, how can you write to someone, you should kill yourself basically because you've cheated? Is that like someone mentioned about the idea of morality and how morality is linked to this? But who are we? Everyone's human. Everyone makes mistakes. There's no right reason to be like, yes, you cheated, so kill yourself, because you've been spying, like, because you've done something wrong. Like, really, righteously, you've been spying on someone to get that information, and then you tell them to kill themselves. So morally, where do you stand? Like, the FBI, where do they stand within that text, if you get what I mean?
Yeah, I get completely what you mean. It's just, and I think it's James Comey as well, says later on in the documentary that there's no such thing as a perfect person, I think he describes it as, and this idea. Mm-hmm. One of the big things this documentary does kind of touch on, one of those key things that's still an issue now, is kind of that idea of the blurring of what is your private life and what is your public life, and that idea. I think, I'm not quite sure which of the interviewees it is, they talk about, you know, the possibility that documentation will be released in 2027, when we see, you know, what will it reveal? And as someone said, you know, we know here in 2021, we knew probably in 1960 that Martin Luther King was not faithful. You know, what does that diminish his power and his impact he's had on the civil rights movement? No, not in any way. Mick, kind of coming to you now, kind of your thoughts in that letter. I mean, was that something, again, kind of you were aware of prior to the documentary? If not, you know, what were your thoughts?
No, I think it does a really good job of really highlighting exactly that moral ambiguity around the FBI. One of the things we need to remember about Hoover, and it was mentioned in the film, that was the guy who set this up. He set it up in about 1926, something like that. And I'm old enough to remember him retiring in the 1970s. That guy was director of the CIA for 52 years. And he had no business really going after King once he, because their primary concern in the 50s post the war was communist infiltration. It was this was at the height of the Cold War. It was an absolute obsession. And really, they were more interested in Stanley Levitt or Sidney Levinson, Stanley, who was a Jewish lawyer from New York and was acting as a conciliary, if you like, to King. And I think just interpreting the way the film works out, really it was the collaboration between King and Levinson that brought this and gave it its huge scale, basically calling on the United States. And that's one of the powerful moments, I think, of filling out the mall, as Johanna says. It getting the nation to stand to its promise under its constitution to all its citizens. But that is exactly what scared the living daylights out of the like of Hoover. And the other thing that struck me as well is that Hoover had been for years playing the propaganda war, talking about, first of all, how the FBI had taken on gangsters, but then had it seeped on to this anti-communist conspiracy nut stuff. And coming finally back to the letter, I think what that tells you really, and what was really quite distressing about it, was that it had an effect on King. It absolutely had an. It was there to undermine his confidence. It wasn't there seriously. It was morally ambiguous, or the wording was such that if you read it, it wouldn't say go and kill yourself. But that's certainly the message that King and his aides certainly took from it. And it clearly discombobulated him and distressed him, put huge pressures on him and his family. It was really kind of a lifting of the veil. But of course, and what was really interesting to me about the summations as it came, it was this accounting of it. It almost begs the question: is there a great man? Can there be a great man if there is this kind of moral ambiguity going on in his personal life? And I think when you see the effects, and what I thought was really interesting, the third character, not a character, as Johanna says, it's not really a character, but there are three great figures in this film. Martin Luther King is the primary of them. Then you've got his nemesis or his shadow, which is J. Edgar Hoover. And then you've got his, first of all, his ally, President Johnson, who brings forth really grabs people in Congress by the collar and makes them bring forth civil rights legislation, which apparently changes everything. But all the time, you've got Hoover in on him going, you can't trust this guy. He's linked in with communists. And there's a couple of great scenes, which I guess are staged in the Oval Office, but with the original voice of Johnson talking to Hoover or someone in the FBI. And those shadowy conversations all kind of showing us the dark side of Washington and the dark side of counter-espionage. I mean, it was brilliantly done. One of the things I think, because it's almost all shot in black and white, is that it takes the brightness off King as this iconic leader, and it shows us many of his other struggles that we wouldn't normally see. It's like almost, you know, they say in sunlight, sunlight shines, puts huge light on some things, but creates great shadows behind it. It's almost like we were looking in moonlight, where you could see the light more evenly spread across the character. And I thought that was great.
I think the only things I can think of that are in color is stuff like the FBI story and all that kind of archive footage from TV shows. I know one of the bit of archive footage that the director is most proud of is his appearance. I can't remember who was the host, but the chat show, which is something the director admitted he had never seen before, hadn't seen, and then it was that when they found it, they unearthed it. And again, that is a way of giving us a more rounded view to an extent of someone like Martin Luther King. And coming back to what Mick said, you know, we have someone in J. Edgar Hoover who had openly said, I think, is it he feared the emergence of a black messiah, and they referred to Martin Luther King as most dangerous Negro for the future of the Union. It's alarming things to hear from agencies that are there supposedly to protect and serve. But from listening to Mick, this is the question, and feel free, whoever wants to answer first. Are you shocked? We have the context of historical kind of looking back at things, and we've had 4 years of the Trump presidency. But to see kind of the lawmakers, FBI, operating in that murky area, you know, we think of kind of Edward Snowden as well, to a lesser extent as well, all that stuff. Are we surprised by what we see in this documentary? Go on ahead, Joanna, you have your hands up.
Well, it's a bully nation. You know, you have bullies. Like, whenever, you know, it was like he got sent a letter to shunning him and telling him to kill himself. Like, this is something that should have happened in a schoolyard. You know, it's on this scale where, like, these are people who, you know, deal with everyone's lives and make sure that, you know, this nation doesn't fall apart. And this is they're people who have other people's lives in their hands, and they act in this way, and that's out of fear, and it's out of fear of who he is and what he stands for, and that they have no control over it, like any bully does. And as, you know, Mick had mentioned, the time that how long Hoover has been in this position, in a top position within this organization, and even whenever they were saying, you know, that the G-Man, you know, propaganda, like the images of these kind of you guys shooting guns and all this kind of stuff, you know, it's like, how can they not see they're as bad as the people that they're trying to stop or they're trying to protect the nation from? But, you know, they're smart, and they're smart bullies. And I think, you know, that is something that maybe this extra footage actually comes out in the next few years. You'll have a film about Hoover, you know, and what actually the FBI have done. And that makes me not surprised about, you know, some of the behaviours. I was surprised about the letter, but again, I had seen that in Selma as well. But this time it was, again, with the emotion kind of removed, and that idea of the investigation made it then seem, in comparison to then archive footage and actual events that happened, the letter then just seems so bizarre. Do you know, just this kind of point where you went, what? What happened? How did that get past anyone? So, you know, and I think, you know, whenever someone said that, you know, the racial order in the US, that's really all that was happening there, and that there was a fear of that, and it was that people didn't want Black people to change this. And this is why Hoover was liked by more people than MLK. He was your kind of, you know, grandfather kind of figure who's been around protecting everyone for so long. And, you know, he started the FBI to look after everyone. And if he doesn't like Martin Luther King, then of course, you know, you won't either. Like, people have to kind of remember, you know, this kind of the Uncle Sam kind of way that people get sucked in. And that's the same thing with people getting obsessed with America being great again, like with Trump. So it's this kind of, you know, way of I don't know, I'm rambling now, but
no, you're fine, because, you know, it did, you know, when you talk like that, and when you hear kind of the way that they know whether by putting it, kind of they sold the FBI and its image, you don't get surprised. You sadly don't get surprised when you see that there's support for people like Donald Trump. And that's a bit of a leap, I know. But it's just when you look back at things, you come back to that point I said at the start of this recording. It's sad how things that you think from the 1960s should be no longer relevant issues, should no longer be things for aspiration or anything like that, that they're still issues. They're still as relevant now as they were back then. It does depress you. And, you know, one of the things, now this is the one thing I will say that I would have liked to have seen more of in the documentary, or even a documentary in its own right. And we hear Northern Ireland, we've had a history of informers and things like that. But one of the things I was most surprised at is the amount of people within King's inner circle that were FBI informers. Like, the photographer that they said was there from almost the start, from that civil rights movement, had taken so many of these iconic photos. That genuinely surprised me. There was other people that, again, were in that inner sanctum, that inner circle of King's political movement and the civil rights movement that were informers. And I suppose, you know, Mick, coming to you, I mean, that will be no surprise. We've seen that, you know, that has been, informers have been in, they've been a very topical issue here in Northern Ireland. But that was one thing that I found really surprising in this documentary, that I maybe, if I was to criticize slightly, I'd say I would want to see more about that, or even, as I say, a documentary on its own about that story.
Yeah, I think there's potential in that. But, you know, it is a standard operating procedure in the way generally that you get an informers to find some compromising information about them. I mean, anybody wants to see some an interesting account of some of the compromising behaviours in the Vatican at the moment, should get themselves a copy of the London Review of Books this month, where Colm Tobin has written an amazing account of what goes on in there. Anywhere where there are secrets kept, there are huge vulnerabilities to informers, particularly to federal agencies in the US who have, you know, huge deep pockets. And the same with the Secret Service over here, you know, the MI5, MI6. So I think that's just, for me, that's just part of the deep landscape. The deeper question that I think this question really throws up, and this is something I hadn't really realized, because obviously I was, as a kid, kind of almost traumatized by the news of Martin Luther King's shooting at the time. So I hadn't really thought about what it was he was doing and how it was different from what he'd done earlier on before. But he was trying to lead a thing called the Poor People's Campaign, you know, and there are snatches in the film that talk about, it was about trying to address the issues of the poor and the disinherited. And he specifically talked about African-Americans, Native Americans, and poor Appalachian whites. And it seems to me, you know, what you've got there is King really not that interested in race per se, but in inequality, lack of opportunity for people kind of to punch up in a republic which was that holds all men equal, and is still struggling to hold that promise. That's why, in a sense, African Americans are still in many places like Massachusetts, Boston. You know, there was an interesting report from the Boston Reserve Bank just talking about how few assets African Americans in Boston have compared to the average. And you compare that to places like Atlanta and Georgia, where there's a critical mass of African American business owners who have no problem employing other people who like them. And this is the thing that really struck me about the G-Men, is they were able to say there was an archetype, because Hoover had an idea what a G-Man looked like. He had to have been some kind of a sportsman, an athlete. Generally, they were over 5 foot tall. They were nearly always male, and in every single case, white. So there was no, and the mocking, one of the reasons why they knew it was the letter was a fake, because it was some white G-man trying to get what he thought how black people would send a threatening letter and, you know, badly failing, so to speak. So there's something there about his instinct, I think, was for the fight for inequality, not just for African Americans, but for everyone that he saw downtrodden within the federal state. And for me, that's an epic story. You know, the footnote about the informers and all the rest of it. Well, we now know, certainly from our experiences in Northern Ireland, that that's how it's worked. That Dennis Donaldson is a classic case of someone who's compromised, and then the state is then fully open to taking them in and pulling them in. And we've seen at least hints that I'm not sure in our lifetimes we're ever going to see the books on Northern Ireland fully open on that score in quite the way. You realise, you know, freedom of information, a lot of this stuff has come through that. The Americans have had freedom of information, whatever their shortcomings as a society, they've had it for nearly 50 years. We've had it for about 20, and we're still finding government departments that won't even tell us really, you know, relatively uncontroversial detail in case it embarrasses the minister or the, as the OFM, DFM, civil servants once laughingly said, if we give you this detail, the minister might not get reelected. So whatever we think about American standards, our own standards are probably a long way short in that respect.
Yeah, we'll not throw stones if we're in glass houses. We'll definitely go for that. And just kind of, I think it was Joanna, you mentioned it, and just listening to Mick, and I don't want to be sensationalist in that way, but when we talk about what Hoover had and his vision he had for the G-Men, does it not in any way remind you of Hitler and the Hitler Youth and that idea of that vision of kind of what someone should be and what he wants and what he wanted it to represent? Again, I'm not trying to be sensationalist for sensationalist sake, but there's an undeniable kind of similarity and kind of that approach on trying to sell off what he thinks the youth and what he thinks a G-Man should be. That's just me. Moving away, coming back to yourself, Esther, we talked there about the freedom of information and the fact that we will see more information potentially released. We're not 100% certain it should be released in 2027. Is that something, that your general thoughts on whether, well, I suppose there's a real argument on whether it should be released or not, but what would that interest you to know that little bit more, that further details about things that we're talking about here and now?
I think I want it to be released because it's like, you know, it's part of history. You can't hide it. It's what's happened. I think the main issue is about how it would change the perception of Martin Luther King. That was what was all the people who were interviewed, the interviewees, that's what they kind of came towards. And from actually just going online and seeing everyone's perception as well, it's how people are going to see him. It's a decisive thing. I think cheating is something very interesting because there are lots of people saying that, oh, if he's not loyal in his marriage, he's not going to be a loyal person, or he's not, like, you know, someone to be trusted. And I'm just like, does it make a difference? You need to separate the art from the artist. I know that's like such kind of infamous like thing, but him cheating has nothing to do with what he did for the civil rights movement. Him cheating has nothing to do with his ideologies or his policies. Him cheating has nothing to do with anything. But having that information, it would just muddy up his character a little bit more. And is this a fact that do you want that to happen? Because there's going to be a huge another generation coming up being like, oh, you shouldn't glorify this man because he did this, or because they found this, like, you know, the rape accusations, the orgy like accusations and stuff like that. That definitely would muddy up a man, because I think as humans we like to feel like we are superior, not superior, but like morally superior to others, being like, oh no, we won't do that, or we don't want to see someone that we care about do that. So we can stand on our high horse and be like, yes, he was a reverend, he shouldn't have cheated, he shouldn't have been in a rape allegation, he shouldn't have been in an orgy, therefore we won't support him or anything that he believed in, and just tarnish anything like that. So, and that line, I feel like it shouldn't, or maybe it should be released with like a warning, you know, being like, this is what you see, but you need to kind of separate it from reality, or this is what happens, but it was found in, like, it was the gap information was gathered in a muddied way. Because if it wasn't for the FBI tapping, we wouldn't know this information, and we'll just go on thinking that Martin Luther was this amazing man who is morally amazing and stuff like that.
So can I quickly say something, Jim, with that? This always just brings me back to religion in America. If he hadn't have been a preacher, if he hadn't have been married, if he was a single man who was having his ladies and enjoying himself in whatever way he personally wanted to.
Nicely put, Joanna, nicely put. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this would be different. And what you can see now is, like, and like you're saying, Esther, future generations now, people, you know, don't all get married when they're 21, don't stay in relationships that they're in. And the same thing historically, you need to think, and, you know, what is a sin as well, you know, and what, you know, in people's minds. And I think the church at the time, and some of the church now, is that thing, and that pressure of things behind closed doors. You don't do anything wrong, you don't tell anyone you're doing anything wrong, and if you're married, you know, that's the sanctity. And yes, of course, it was hypocritical of him to stand up and be a preacher and do the other things that he was doing, but at the same time, he's a human being, and if he wasn't in those positions and he was a single man doing it another time, not religious, you know, these days it wouldn't be written down like this evil that it was for him, perhaps.
Yeah, in fact, I would have to say about it's sometimes to do with race as well, because if you look at Bill Clinton, for example, Bill Clinton, he cheated. And in fact, it was like a massive one, but people still see him as this kind of hero, like, oh, look, it's good old Bill. But because a black man dared to cheat, a black, like, reverend dared to cheat, is this, like, oh, no, hearsay, let's all cry. It's the same, but it's not treated the same way.
Yeah, that's the point I was going to make. I think it was because Martin Luther King was basically asking to be treated equally, and he had to be on some higher moral plane. You know, it's that people, you often see this now when people come to ask for equality and rights, they have to hold themselves up to a higher standard. You think of people throughout history, that particularly in this country that we uphold, you know, Churchill is a character that has really undergone a real change over the past couple of years, and despite the fact that the man was out and out racist and was arguably involved in genocide in India, you know, he is upheld as this upstanding gentleman. But for people who come forward and ask for equal rights, they are expected to be above and beyond. And I do wonder, you know, if that was why they went for this, because they knew that if they wanted, that would be, if they exposed this about King, about his affairs, it would give people a reason not to listen to what he was going to say. Because people are always looking for reasons not to believe activists and to believe people when they come forward. And you see it now when people come forward and ask stuff, it's like, well, they're not actually that nice a person. And I think I agree with Esther's point. There is a race element to this, and that for Martin Luther King, he had to be seen as this pure, perfect man, because there would be, if he was anything less, then people would just ignore him, and which is unfair.
I'd add something to that, which is, actually, the truth is, if you look back at that era and the epic nature of his rhetoric and what it signified, the huge scale of the problems that he was talking about and successfully addressing, that prurience is in the FBI, but it's not in journalism. One of the key differences between MLK and, say, the likes of Clinton is it came out during Clinton's actual office. Kennedy got away with it. You know, I don't know that Nixon was involved in any of that, but the point is, now we're not really interested in the epic, we're interested in whatever. And this film, not because, I mean, it's no fault of the filmmakers, because I think they handle it really powerfully. There's a testimony towards the end that says, look, King's work will simply not be affected. It's too robust to be affected by the tittle-tattle of what happened, what noises off there were. And I think that's a real shift in times. If you watch this stuff, and it really feels like the whole nation is moving. And nowadays you feel, well, they only move as quickly as they can find whatever dirt they can get on Biden or Kamala Harris or whatever else it is. And American politics, and I think politics in the world generally, has gone from this epic scale to this almost sitting room drama of who's messed up, you know, more badly than the next one. I mean, we've just gone through 4 years of listening to a president who communicated through tweets, for goodness sake, and did it by scandalizing a liberal media that forgot that they had to hold him to account for the way he ran the country, not how he wrote on his Twitter feed. And I think that's one of the reasons why I find this really refreshing, is to go back and find someone who is, I consider to be, a grounded hero.
Yeah, I would completely agree, Mick. It's the idea. And I'll go around the panel. I'll start with you, Joanna, whatever way I'm looking at him in my screen. I mean, this doesn't, the fact that Dr. Martin Luther King was an adulterer, like, one of the things they talk about in the documentary is that the notes the FBI had, we talked about that orgy, it was audio recordings, but yet they somehow scribbled down, he looked and smiled. I don't know how you can kind of see video from audio, but maybe more will be revealed on that. But I don't think that, as Mick says, it doesn't change, you know, what he achieved and what he tried to achieve with the civil rights movement. I don't think that in any way. I don't think we, I suppose it's this danger of, do we want our heroes to be squeaky clean? Do we want these people to be, you know, as James Comey said, these perfect people? I don't think that. I think it just humanizes the man, but it does not in any way take away from his achievements. You know, for you? Does it take away from these kind of revelations that aren't revelations or things I knew of before the doc watching the documentary, but they don't change my thoughts on the man himself?
No, it doesn't. And anyone in any high power situation, and even like within the church itself, the hierarchy within the church, a lot of priests and preachers are targeted by other people as this kind of, oh my goodness, sister, this wonderful people. And they have almost people that can worship them. And so if you're a man in his position, you're having a really hard time, you're stressing out about something, and you have, I'm not saying women throwing themselves at him, but these people who idolize him and will go do anything for them, you can get into situations where that kind of worship level boundaries get crossed. And that is like throughout all of the church, this happens all the time. And I think as well, you know, I'm not like making excuses for him, but you know, in Selma, you get to see a bit more of like, you know, the struggles that he's going through, the emotions he's going through, him as a person. And, you know, I don't think he can judge, you know, just things that people do. You know, it doesn't take away from anything that he had done. And I think, you know, I'm not sitting here, you know, in a court about, you know, his wife wanting to get divorced by him. You know, it's, you know, and that's why I was talking about kind of these rules in society. And that's why I'm going back to, if he had been a single man, things would have been different. And so, yeah, it doesn't take away with what he's done. But what blows me away is that I'm sitting here, I'm 35 years old. What have I done? You know, this guy was 38 years old, and in such a short period of time out of that, not for his entire 34 years, 38 years, the stuff that he was able to do and what he was able to achieve, he was also in the right place at the right time. And, you know, and I think him actually being a preacher really prepared him for being a public speaker and prepared him for being who he was and being strong. And also he would have had more followers because of his religion. So at the time, it probably worked very well for him in the position that he was in. And I think that's why he was kind of able to get to that point. And what you see now, like if you think of the couple of years that he changed civil rights movement, like imagine the poor people's campaign, if he had been able to continue that, if he had been still alive, what else he would have been able to do at the time. But what you find is then when he was cut in his prime, that was a massive thing for all people of all nations that weren't white. You know, that was a point where things went back to then being that kind of ruling of white people and of different people who don't listen to the civil rights movement, don't think about other people, and things are left to the point that they are now. If someone stands up and tries to be an MLK today, it'll be so much harder for them as an individual to be able to make as big a difference at this time, because again, you know, there's so much going on. And even when Mick was talking about, you know, Twitter and, you know, social media and things like that. But I just wonder, you know, what else he could have done if he hadn't have died at that right time, at that right moment where injustice was so rife, whereas now injustice has just always been there and it's just in the carpet and it's just in America, that's what's kind of there. Whereas this could have been so much more of a big thing, you know.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it's whataboutery, I know, but you know, it's very true what you say. Esther, coming to yourself, you know, your thoughts and the revelations on King's private life, you know, I it's my own humble opinion, I don't think it changes my own mind on what he achieved. I don't think in my mind it does, but for you, do you think it can really shape what he achieved in that limited time?
So I found out that he cheated when I was like, I think maybe 14. I saw it on like one of the blog threads when I was four. I'm like 21 now. So like I was very quite young. So I saw it and I was like, oh my God, that's the worst thing you could ever do. Like, how can you be so holy, like holier than thou, a religious man, and cheat? And like, then after that, I was like, yeah, you can't do this. But I said that for him, not his work. Like, it doesn't change the way I thought about what he did. He still, without him, the civil rights movement, like Joanne said, would not have gone as far as it went. Like, we don't know what type of world we'd be living in now if he did not do the work he did. So the fact that he cheated, the fact that my gut instinct at the age of 14 was he was a horrible, not horrible man, but like, you know, a horrible person to do that. And now obviously going through my through my ages, realizing that people aren't perfect. Like, yeah, 14-year-old, you can think that that's the worst thing that can ever happen in the world. There's a lot more bad, like a lot more horrible things that can be done. So like coming from that, I tell my brother, I look to my family and I'm just like, this is not the worst thing that someone can do. Just because he cheated, it's not for us to judge him. That's his family's business. If they want to have their own way with him and like just like decide to abandon him completely, that's his family's business. That's not our business. Because where do we have a stake in that conversation as the public? We don't. We have no stake in that. It's the same way that if I cheated, I wouldn't want a random person being like, you're a horrible person, because they don't know the story. We can come up with like lots of arguments, lots of excuses for why he did it or why he shouldn't have done it, but it doesn't change the fact that it's happened. And we don't have an excuse for it or an excuse to say, oh no, he shouldn't have done it. It's done. And his family, I'm not sure if they've forgiven him for that aspect, but it seems like the way that his daughter still goes on social media to like praise him every Martin Luther King Day to understand the work that he's done, it seems like the family's come to terms with it and are still like happy to praise him as a father. So we have no rights to be like, yes, this is the reason why he should be hated / everything he's done should be like pushed to the wind. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, just kind of listening to you talking, Joanna and Esther, it reminds me a little bit of kind of, to an extent, of we've seen recently with Marcus Rashford and kind of who's become the real campaigner for the school meals and kind of been had such a big influence on UK politics. But we've already seen that's moving away from, you know, the kind of security side of things to journalism. We've already seen like figures like that are already kind of trying to chink away at him and looking for any excuse to kind of not kind of devalue what he's kind of doing. I think was it earlier this year or last year? Sorry, the Daily Mail kind of were bringing up the issues about that he had bought so many houses for his family and things like that, and which is completely irrelevant. But all that does to try and do is to kind of undermine someone, and that's someone who's putting his head up above the pulpit and is kind of standing up for what he believes and things. You see that there will always be someone out there who will be looking to chink away. But that was just listening to you both. Sarah, coming to you, you know, your thoughts. Does it really, as Esther has said, there are worse things that people can do. I'm not kind of in any way kind of saying that's, oh, it's not that bad what he did. But yeah. does it kind of take away your idea of his impact as a civil rights?
No, it doesn't take away any of his achievements and what he did. I think any revelations that come out, I think, impact how we see him as a person. So, you know, if something came out that he was present where someone was sexually assaulted, raped, I mean, that is going to change how I think about him as a person. But I'm not going to I'm not going to say, oh, well, everything he did was awful and terrible. You know, I think that when we look back at historical figures, the truth is really what matters, not really how we feel about them. You know, and I mean, coming back to what I was talking about Churchill earlier, I mean, Churchill was an awful man. He did also very good things, you know, and I think that's fine. You take the whole person, you know, and I think, you know, I think that's not that I'm comparing King and Churchill, by the way, and put them on the same pedestal, but just as an example. But it the truth is what matters, you know, and if it doesn't take away anything that he did, you know, the man is praised and upheld, and he did so much. And I think that's just how we will always see him, even if we might change how we view him individually. But I think that's fine. You know, it's fine to look back at people in history. There's even people alive today. You know, we have idolized him. I have a picture of Obama on my wall. I mean, Obama was not a perfect person. He was not a perfect president. And that's fine. And I think we need to be okay with looking back at historical figures and just being like, nah, you know, they weren't really how we thought about them when we were younger. I think it's healthy for us to do that.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that's been a big thing that's arose from the Black Lives Matter. Mick, coming to yourself to kind of wrap up this little bit, you know, do these revelations for you kind of change your kind of thoughts on King's achievements and what he achieved within the civil rights movement?
Yeah, I think I have a greater appreciation of the breadth of his vision, to be honest. You know, I hadn't really picked up, as I said before, I hadn't really picked up the nuance of what he was doing in the last year of his life and this campaign on to basically bring poor people into the riches of the Republic, the American Republic. I mean, for me, the whole thing, it's less about, I mean, what I think about King is really irrelevant on the scale of things. You know, it's what I think of his personal life is even less. You know, I may be shocked at some of the things that come out when they're released fully in 20, 2017, but I'll leave it till then to make those kinds of judgments. I think this film, if we go back to that, is, you know, my first thought was it's a morality tale, but then no, morality tales are sort of the things that Greeks always tell you to warn you away from terrible things that might happen. It's sort of related to tragedy and stuff like that. But actually, I think it's more of a nuanced essay in morality. And the fact is that King was no more or no less human than the rest of us. There was a huge amount of pressure on him. But one of the things, you know, there's an interesting thing that I think we Irish, really take for granted a little bit, especially with the decline of churches, both north and south, is there something comes in with all the stuff that we are in a rush to get rid of and to throw off our backs. There's a whole line of moral thinking that we're in grave danger of losing. And there's a line really near the beginning of the film where they talk about who else would have done anything this stupid but a bunch of people who go to church in Alabama. Because who else would think they had a pup's chance in hell of winning? And there's a point where one of his confidants says, he warned us that we were mad to take this fight on, and yet we did it because we had moral vision. Or he referenced again the word moral, and it comes up time and time and time again through this film. And it's moral vision, or the ability to see the world as it might be rather than just keep on accepting it the way it is. Marcus Rashford, I think, is a good point, not just because, you know, he's because of his race, but because of the moral stand. What Rashford has done is what King did, was to make visible the otherwise invisible, the people who are basically having to take it as the rest of us make all our decisions in absence of any real knowledge of what they're going through. And I think, you know, and it's an easy point to make that he has maybe more than one house, but he said the problem there is the Premiership football thing. It's nothing to do with Rashford. But because he has, because he has that opportunity to pick that fight, not just once, but twice already, and win against a political class that no longer seems to recognize that morality is a thing they have to reckon with. I think King is a really powerful story, and all the better for us seeing it in this moonlight, with the light and the dark more evenly spread than just the charisma of a great man.
Yeah, completely agree. You know, we've been talking for just over an hour. I think we're all very positive about the documentary. As we said, you can get that through links and you can help support The Strand. I would say this kind of, as we start to bring things to a close, I mean, is anything else that anybody really feels that they want to discuss, or anything we haven't really mentioned at this point? Or is there anything, like, for me, I have a few suggestions for further viewing. I would always suggest they're pretty straightforward kind of suggestions. And if anybody even wants to kind of bring anything in kind of a contemporary kind of context and the revelation of what this documentary is talking about and putting it into now in 2021.
Can I just go in first? I think it was just a couple of quickly things. I think for me, the one when I was talking earlier about the similarities was the link between how they linked communism to the civil rights movement. They're doing that now with Black Lives Matter. They're saying, oh, it's a Marxist, cultural Marxism and all this nonsense. And I think there's you can tie that into absolutely in America as to how leftist ideas and socialist ideas have been seen in America for a very long time, and how they've always had this very weird obsession with communism. And obviously it comes from the Cold War, but I think it goes deeper than that. It's very much about what King wanted to do was to shake the foundations of America and what it was. He was anti-capitalist himself, and that was a threat, and that was part of the reason why he was challenged so much. So that was one thing. And I also just think we were talking about how King is perceived. I also think how King is perceived has changed anyway. Like, you get people quoting Martin Luther King now and they use him to go against the Black Lives Matter protesters. They kind of said, oh, they're the same, but King was, you know, King was shot and killed, and he was the same things that are fired at the Black Lives Matter protesters was fired at King as well. So I think that's the only thing I really kind of wanted to say, is how I think with ourselves, we have changed how we think about King. He's upheld as being like this very noble civil rights activist, but you just know that the people quoting him today would have absolutely slayed him at the time.
There is that line, I'm not quite certain who said it, near the end of this documentary, where they talk about violence will not succeed in changing this nation. And it was very kind of, I suppose we have those images from what we've seen only a few weeks ago in Capitol Hill. It was kind of just very fresh in my head, and we've had that in over the last 4 years, the right versus the left, and all those issues that have arose within that. And of course we have the Black Lives Matter, that, as I say, you know, they are still as relevant now and as they were back then. Joanna, Esther, Mick, anything you want to come in to throw in as we wrap up this podcast?
Yeah, I just had one. It's just to follow on the point that about if a white person did this, or if a white man were in the same position as Martin Luther King, how they wouldn't get as much, not grief, but basically grief. But because the documentary actually rightfully pointed out the idea of sexuality and black men, particularly how it's like changed throughout the ages, you know, not even changed, how it's perceived throughout ages. And I think that that is so relevant to today worldwide. It's like an issue for black men to become this hypersexualized being that everyone sees them as. They see them as this like predator, basically. And that's why people were very uncomfortable with the idea that King was having different extramarital relationships, the idea that him in an orgy, or like, you know, being so vulgar in the rape accusation, like it resonated and hit home. And I think it would hit home even to black families, not only because in the documentary, I think what we got was white outrage, in the sense that it was the white woman thinking that, oh yeah, when Hoover sent out the kind of newspaper article about him being a notorious liar, it was, you normally get the white voices saying that he's too smart, I never liked him, I didn't trust him. But the idea of sexualization and like this predator has been ingrained within the site, well, like black society and white society, to death, to fear the predator, white, black men, sorry. So within black families as well, they will be shocked and like it will morally shake them. So his supporters will be like, how can we support this man who is the epitome of the black rapist, in a sense? And yeah, I didn't like that. But I thought the documentary did well to point that out as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that also plays into, you see, and the documentary touches on it as well, portrayals in The Birth of a Nation. Yeah. You know, that's all things that I suppose comes from that. Joanna, Mick, anything you want to throw in at this point as we bring things to a conclusion?
Yeah, I agree. Like what Esther was saying, it's a whole other can of worms. And even just like the footage that was shown depicting men in the cartoon, in a cartoonist way, and this kind of evil figure has sadly not went away, even to the point where people can't walk through the park in peace without someone else accusing them of attacking them or antagonizing them. And I think there's a lot of other documentaries that cover it. And one thing that I think would go quite well along with this one is I Am Not Your Negro, which it's a difficult one because I was almost wanting to do a podcast with it, but I'm not very comfortable with saying the title all of the time. And the way that, you know, it, even at that, like even the title is so abrasive, you know, it's very different, but it will go through and talk about a lot of people kind of around Martin Luther's time, and other kind of black men essentially who kind of led the way in America at that time. It's on the QFT player, which is the other independent cinema in Belfast. So you can watch it through the QFT player, I think, for the next week or two. And it's £3.50. So, you know, that's a really good price. And it might be on the BFI player as well. But yeah, I think it's just more, you know, it's important for us to go and watch other films, watch films with black voices, watch art that is made by black people, you know, and especially like the next global film screening. So let's do a little plug, which is in March. We're going to be discussing, along with the Golden Thread and Join Her Network, the recent series that Steve McQueen's been doing on the BBC, and the films that are being made there about very specific times in England. And kind of, again, it's one of those things that kind of normalizes those black males that you, Esther, that you were talking about, and seeing people as normal people, as not scary, as husbands, as lovers. You know, it's, and those are the things that we need to champion, and we need to kind of just be watching and promoting and pushing that to other people. Because, you know, I think film is one of the best ways to learn and change your perceptions.
I would agree, John. You know, it's one of those, cinema is that window into other people's lives, people that you may never meet, may never get the opportunity to speak to. But by spending time with them through an hour and a half, 2 hours of a film, you can learn more about their life. And with it, I suppose, more about yourself. The documentary that I went out and really finally sought out last year at the reemergence of the Black Lives Matter was Ava DuVernay's 13th, which is just an absolutely fantastic documentary. And it does, it's in a way, it's a gateway drug. It helps you kind of see things from somebody else's point of view. And then you can see then into a film, like, to go full Jim McLean horror cliche, something like even just Get Out, you know, which is another film I absolutely love, made by a black filmmaker who has interesting things to say about society and the portrayal of black people within society and popular culture.
And 13th is on Netflix for free, is what I wanted to mention there. Yeah.
Mick, for yourself, just kind of as we bring things to a close, any kind of closing thoughts?
No, I think in terms of learning, I think one of the reasons why this film works is that it's the archives, as I said at the beginning. I think there's a lot of really new, fresh stuff on an old subject. What I take away from it, well, I will look up some of those films that you've just mentioned. I think I think people should be inspired. They should be inspired by it. One, it's a reminder that democracy is not a thing; it's us. And democracy is only as healthy as the full muscular way that we engage with it. And if we refuse to engage with it, then it will very, very quickly fall in to the autocrats, the hands of the autocrats, and life will simply get worse. And I think that people should, there's a line that comes from the very, very beginning. And I think this is really something that we need to remember in this moment, when our voices are all breaking up, when we're being invited to disagree with each other, not always on points of substance, but just for the sake of giving up. And it goes, and this is all to do with the March on Washington. We're going to swallow up hatred with love. That may come across corny when I say it. It's not corny in the film, and it's really properly, strategically well framed, because they knew as they walked on Washington just how frightened the rest of white America was going to be. But they were determined to come and sublimate all those stereotypes and basically call the United States to be everything it could be. That applies to the United States, applies to us in Northern Ireland. We've got some really deep wells of hatred that we've really got to calm. And the only way to do it is to smother it with love and collective action and moving towards the future together as equals. And that is a job that needs doing now. It's not something that was done for us in the 60s or even in 1998 with the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. That has to be done every single day by every single one of us.
Mick, I think that's, it's a lovely way to bring this podcast to a close. I can't think of any of my typical rambly, canny rambleness will not kind of get away. So I'm not going to undermine that by talking too much more. But no, I again, it's the cliche thing I always get mocked for saying. I totally agree with what you're saying. It is so true. It's not just kind of, there is no us and them. It's just us. And that's why we've all kind of got to work together in some time of shape or form. So yes, as I've said earlier on, I think we're all very positive about this documentary. It is available through various VOD platforms, but if your interest has been tweaked by what we've been discussing, you can seek it out and you can help support your local Strand, the Strand Arts Centre here in Belfast, by renting it through Dogwhiff's online player. And we will have the links for this on the bio for this podcast. So that pretty much brings everything to a close. So all that's left for me to do now is just go round this virtual panel and thank you all. So thank you very much, Joanna.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Esther.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, Mick.
Bye.
So that pretty much brings this podcast to a close. Thanks to Esther, Mick, Sarah and Joanna. I think that's everybody who took part in our virtual panel for MLK FBI. And more importantly, of course, thanks to you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. If this was your first time checking out the pod, you can find our complete back catalogue on our website at www.banderflix.com. And there not only will you find the backlog And there not only will you find the backlog of our podcast, but also our TV show on NVTV. And of course, we've reviews and features. I know our very own Victoria Brown has just written a lovely piece about the 60th anniversary of 101 Dalmatians. And when you're on the website, you might even want to check out our Patreon page to see some of the goodies that you can get through supporting us. And that helps us carry on doing the pod, particularly in these uncertain times when we're not able to put on events right now. It definitely helps. And I know we have a couple of patrons. So, you know, thank you guys. You know who you are. Thank you for your support. You get your pods earlier than anybody else. And you also get some extra pods as well. So it's definitely worthwhile checking out. And yeah, so That's pretty much everything I have to do. You know, just a quick heads up. As I said at the start in my introduction, we're not going to be reissuing any old pods for a little while. We took a little break over Christmas, a much needed break to recharge the batteries, but it's great to be back doing the pods, I have to admit. You know, the hour or so, the hour and a half that it takes to record them, it's something to do, something to talk about, talking about movies, something I love to do, and it's great to be able to do it again. So in the coming weeks, we are going to have some new pods for you. Next week, our pod is all about WandaVision. It's a comic book 101. We haven't done those for quite some time. We're doing those again with Aaron Flanagan from the Comic Book Guys, great comic book shop here in Belfast. And it's not really an in-depth discussion on WandaVision because we recorded it only after two episodes had aired on Disney Plus. It's more so about the comic book origins of the characters, the writers, the artists, how their origins differ slightly from what we've seen on screen, and also some of the notable comic book issues and stories you maybe want to seek out after watching WandaVision. I've just seen the third episode and thought it was great. I'm definitely intrigued. It'll be interesting to see what you guys think at home. But that's really that. I know we also have some new crime scene to screen on the way. Therese and Joe have recorded that. I believe it's all about the Zodiac Killer. It's a two-parter. So you'll get the first part in Feb and the second part in March. And I mentioned earlier on Victoria Brown, our resident Disney Queen. I'll be teaming up with her again pretty soon, I would say, in February, as we delve once again into the dark age of Disney's back catalogue. And I think we're talking about Winnie the Pooh. I'm very excited about that. Who doesn't love a bit of Winnie the Pooh? So that's all to look forward to. We also have a new regular pod feature with cosplayer Gabrielle Riddio. You'll have maybe heard Gabrielle a couple of times in this pod. She hasn't been on for a while. But we're letting Gabrielle host her own show on the pod. It'll be monthly, where she... Well, at the minute, I was going to say she sits down, but she's once again virtually sitting down with other cosplayers from around the UK and chatting to them about the movies that got them into cosplaying and some of the costumes that they've done. We've had Gabrielle, as I said, on the pod before. She did a panel for us for the Dark Hedges International Film Festival about that, about getting into cosplaying. So I thought we would turn it into a monthly feature. And just heard the first episode, and that's a lot of fun. That'll be with you in Feb. And hopefully as well, we'll have new episodes of We Need to Talk About Movie Music and just general rambly rambleness from yours truly. So yeah, it's great to be back. I know there's a lockdown on. I know that it's all doom and gloom in January right now, but things will get better. And hey, if we can entertain you
whether you're in the bath listening to this, if you're in bed, if you can't sleep, or if you're out for a drive, out for a walk, or if you're just kind of doing a bit of work in the office and you've got us on the background. So hopefully we can keep you entertained. And that's pretty much everything I've got to say. I've been your host, Jim McLean, the editor-in-chief of the Bantaflix Movie Review website. We'll be back next week with another episode. But for now, until then, goodbye.
This has been We Need to Talk About Movies. Thanks for listening. For more information, visit BantaFlix.com. See you next time.